exchange opinions on YouTube or Twitch. I'm looking forward to present you Volume 6 of Operation Mindfuck, presented by Bleeptrack and Blinry. Blinry is a programmer. He does art and designs games. He really loves the community, your recall center and the chaos community. And he visited workshops about origami in the Caribbean. He visited Japan and is really involved with all kinds of arts. Bleeptrack is a creative technology fan. She has participated in various exhibitions. In 2019, she was awarded with a prize and did her first solo exhibition in Ulm. And at the moment, she works at generative visualizations. This speech was pre-recorded, and so we can't do anything about the scaling, we're sorry. But now lean back and enjoy the firework of nerd topics. Hi, and Hi. Welcome to Operation Mindfuck.
This is the sixth edition of this this Bleeptrack. I'm Blinry, and this come kind of a tradition at the end of this year to try to nut snipe you a little bit. So over the year we collect the stuff, and this is how we try to infect you with that as well. So this is a large bucket of themes from art, from the arts, from technique, from science, and let's see what we've done for you. This year we are doing some kind of experiment, a change in format. So we didn't talk to each other on what we are now presenting you. So it's going to be a surprise for the two of us as well.
Cool. Let's start with the first topic.
Okay, then. So this is about a place that no longer exists. And so you got the title. You have the title Randomless Sommelier and the Library of Babel, which is a place. It's about a large library with hexagonal rooms. So this is how they are described in the book. And each room has four walls full of books. And in the story, people are moving through the rooms looking for some special books this library contains, because the library contains every book that's possible. And this is limited to 400 pages each, and about a given alphabet, and each room has all the books that can be built out of these combinations. And for the people in there, it's super interesting because they know every book they could think of exists, and so they are just looking for the lookout of these books. And the great thing is someone has implemented a web version of that. So let's go there and have a look what we can find there. So this is the start page. And so let's browse through that, through the books which are there. So the first thing is let's find some hexagon. So they are identified by their long IDs, like numbers or digits, like up to 3,000 characters long. So there are very, very many rooms. And let's see where we can go. Let's think of a hash, where to go. So let's just randomly hammer on the tastatur.
Or maybe use Operation Mindfuck.
Okay. This is going to be our hexagon. So here we have these four walls. And where should we go?
I would say go to the center.
Okay. Number one, let's zoom in. This hat has five rows, five shelves. So maybe at the center again. Number three, and we see there's lots of books here, like all title that can exist. So anything you like?
Well, the four from the right has a very short title.
Oh, yes. Let's go there. And here we are 410 pages of content. No. So, this is my experience so far. If you, when clicking through, so most of the time you get these kind of books that are not really helpful for anything. But we know that in this library, everything else can be found. Everything can be found. So if we go back, so there's a search function. So if we go through that one for a certain content, so if we search for certain content, we can find this there. So maybe let's search for Operation Mindfuck. And the search function actually finds some hits in the book. For example, on some book where the right in the center, there's a book where Operation Mindfuck just appears in the middle of a book. It's surrounded by noise or things we can't really pass and understand, but Operation Mindfuck is there. And so there are. Let's go to the search again. There are results where this is surrounded by random English words. So obviously our words appear because they exist. And around there are some random words there.
Very beautiful.
Yeah. Okay. Whenever I'm thinking about this, it has so many cool implications that every book is in there, except there. Every book, every written, or maybe the first 10 pages and all variants of that, and all kind of spelling mistakes and typos exist somewhere in this library, or there are subtitles for this talk we're currently having here in all possible languages. Or predictions about the future, and the forecast will be there, the correct prediction, but all the other ones. So all your homework is there, so you just need to search for the answer there. Don't know whether it makes sense to do this. And of course, all scientific papers contained in there. All the right ones, I call all the correct ones, but also all the incorrect ones, of course. So, but this is a little bit connected with a different construct. I don't know whether you've heard of that. It's the infinite Montague theorem, which, so if you put a monkey in front of a typewriter and let them type for infinite amount of time, it will produce all works of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare. So there's a very specific. Technical term. It's a probability of one that this will happen, but it will take a very long time. And indeed, folks tried this out. If it works out, if you let monkeys hammer on keyboards on whether work happens, they ran this for a couple of months, and in total, it turns out that the monkeys produced a total of 5 pages, mostly contained of the letter S. Oh. Then they began striking this with some of the rocks, and so it didn't really work out they were hoping. Okay.
Beautiful.
And then let's hand over to you.
That's really cool. So the Babel fish from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is this derived from the Library of Babel? Oh yeah, so, it's the Tower of Babel.
So So everything falls down, yeah.
Okay, yeah, true. Talking about languages, I'm taking it a step further. I took a font with me. It's FF Beowulf, and it's really interesting. This is a font that was brought to the Museum of Modern Art in New York. It was added to their permanent exhibition or the permanent collection, and it's really intriguing, I think. Like looking into it, it looks like this, and one asks oneself, why is it moving so much? And why is a font in a museum collection? And this is a funny story. Someone on Mastodon raised, I can't remember their nickname now. This font uses some kind of hacky gap in PostScript when it's printed, and in the printing process, the drivers set the points on the outer line of the font, meaning every time when they're setting the font, the letter looks a bit different. And so we see different variants. And this kind of triggered a bit of discussion among typographs, because computers, they change everything, and everything is kind of a bit evil, you know? And to be honest, printer drivers are kind of like black magic. And to me, I found it thrilling that this happened, but unfortunately, it doesn't work that way anymore nowadays. So this is another example, but all of those images I show you now are from a modern variation from OpenType. Because, I mean, to be honest, I don't know too much about printer drivers to be able to explain it well, what was really used there or exploited. But nowadays, it doesn't work this way again. So they reconstructed it with OpenType, and OpenType has the possibility to set alternate symbols. I can put in several small E's that are chosen randomly or arranged in random combinations.
Well, it's not that cool, but yeah.
It's really not that cool, but at least you see the optics, and there's an overlay of three variants of better. And if you want to use that font with Windows, you can also download or buy it. And then there's this five variants with an increasing jitter factor, so to say, that are rebuilt and are in there as an alternative variant.
Wouldn't it be nice if every time you scan or print this, there would be a bit more distortion or degradation?
Yeah, I would also like that. I would really like it if every print, like if you print with a mold, you have kind of an attrition in there or wear and tear. It would be cool with every print that it kind of wears out a little bit more. But it's a license issue with fonts. You have 10 free prints and then it stops. But
yeah,
I like it because it's unexpected that things change while being printed or depending on which driver is used. That's an unexpected experience.
Yes, and it's nice. I think that makers of printers are not really keen on things like this happening.
Yeah, you actually don't want this.
Yeah, but actually this is a Turing complete language, isn't it? So in theory,
yep, exactly.
If you've put in formulas, mathematical terms, then the font actually calculates them for you, and yeah, it can do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that was my part. Back to you.
Okay, we'll look at Quines now. Have you heard of that?
No, not yet.
So these are programs that have a certain feature, and that is that their output is identical to their own source code. And that is a fairly strange property, and it's strange that this is actually possible. And I'll step you through an example. So output equals source code. If you take this very broadly, you could say, okay, how about the empty program? I have brought an example. This is in Python. This is the file name, and I've built the examples in a way that you see the output from the command line. Cat shows you the content of the file. Trivial.py is the file. So if nothing is output, the file is actually empty, and then running it via Python, this program gives you an empty output as well. So you can say, ha, this is identical, right? But normally this is called too trivial. So this is the kind of case that is forbidden. And then there are quines that cheat somehow. This is a cheating quine, a Python program that opens its own file name, reads it, and then prints what is in there. So it kind of uses the fact that the program can know something about itself. So if you run it, the output is identical to the source code, but well, it just did some file IO, and this also is commonly forbidden as something that's too easy. We want something more difficult. And here's another nice cheating quine. You maybe know that shell scripts in their first line can contain a special syntax that says which program should be used to actually run the program. Normally, the program to run would be the bash, the shell, or the which then runs whatever follows in the file. But if you use cat itself as the program, that is the program in the command line that actually outputs a file's content, which we have used before. So if you run that script, then make it executable and run it, then the following happens. The operating system sees what is mentioned in the first line, which should I use to actually execute this script? And it's then, okay, it says cat, so I'm going to use cat. And again, it's a cheating quine because, but I find it quite cool that this is actually possible. But now let's go to a real quine. Again, in Python. If we want to print the program's own source code, we have to print something. So starting with some kind of print is actually a good idea. We have a print question mark here, which includes the string question mark. And if you run it, you only get the question mark. So we don't really know what to use to make it work. And then you might say, well, we want to reproduce our own source code, and so what we want to output is something including the word print. So the next step would be to say, we'll replace the content by the string with something including print and a question mark. And outputting that, okay, gives you print question mark, but what's missing, since we've put this into a string, there is a duplication of the print, and only one of the two prints are in the output, so it's not really identical. And the usual next step then to take is using an auxiliary variable. So we say, okay, we'll define a variable called s, which contains some kind of string, which then is printed. Again, the result is just a question mark, but we could now start and say, this string can contain other things too. And we'll make it so that it's as similar as possible to the actual source code. So we're not going to use a question mark, but actually put in s equals question mark and print s. So it's kind of wrapped into itself. And within the string, basically you have the same structure. If you run this, you get the string, the question mark is there. But again, things are missing, the duplication is missing.
Okay, so it feels like you haven't won anything.
And now You need this kind of step.
So you're asking me how to do the string magic here? So having a string that you escape in a weird way?
Yes, that's the direction we should take, yeah. In Python, there is this kind, this mechanism you called format strings.
Yeah.
So you have something in there that something that's later on replaced. So you can say hello, comma, name. And the name is then replaced by the content of another variable. So this kind of syntax, you could use percentage s to insert a string in other languages. So something like this can be done here where the question mark is. If we print this later on, it is kind of similar to what we want to have, but in place of the question mark, we want the string itself. So in that variable, we could take this variable and put it into itself. And that's the way it looks. And now have s equals quotation mark percentage s. The quotation marks have to be escaped. And I'll jump to the end now. This is the variable s, and it's kind of inserted into itself. This is the syntax you use. The first value is the template, and the second is the values that are inserted into it. And to make it as similar as possible, we put the same thing into the string as well. You have to duplicate the percentage sign so that it escapes itself. So there's something to be done there still. Otherwise, it would crash. But if we do this, the output is quite similar to the source code. We have inserted the string into itself. And can you still see the difference? It's in this escape.
Yes, right? Exactly.
So that is kind of the problem. Once we've escaped this, the string that it has been evaluated only has the quotation mark, and that's what it's inserted. So we are missing those backslashes. So this is quasi good, but we need to go that last step. We could say, okay, we'll use two variants of that string, and in one of these we'll put some extra backslashes, but that will be really complicated. And to avoid this, we are going to write a version that does something similar in principle, but doesn't have the problem that the string has kind of extra quotes in it. And that's just the way this looks. So we use these character 39 thing that is happens to be the apostrophe, single quote, which we also insert.
Nice.
So we have the character, then S and the character again, and in the output then we have these single ticks around the string. So that's what produces these two characters. So in the string we have this replacement with the character function, and outside of it too. But that is actually a real coin, that a program that outputs its own source code. You can make it a bit more simple if you use a certain format string that is percentage %R, which I've learned while preparing this talk, actually, that takes a string and puts a form of the variable in there that looks like the syntax in Python that you should have. So if you use percentage %R and put a string in there, that automatically is given quotes around it, as it should be in Python source code. And that makes it a bit shorter. So if you are listening to this talk, do try this in your favorite programming language. I think this is a super mind-bending activity to get around. And I also brought you a thing that comes from mathematics, a self-replicating formula that someone came up with. This is how it looks. It's defined on the variables x and y. So this is a lattice of pixels, maybe. And if you evaluate this, wherever So you get a pixel wherever the condition that is expressed here is true, and that in that case you color this black, and otherwise you color it white. And if you plot this, this is the image you get. I could hardly believe it when I first saw it. It looks far too. So to encode this, or it should be impossible. And this is actually a bit of a hack, because the question is which area, which region do you restrict this to? You go up to 10 on the y-axis. You have this mysterious k, going from k to k plus 17, and that is the area that contains the formula itself. Should I show you what k
yes.
is?
Yes, please. Oh no.
So that is the area that is kind of coded into that. If you choose another K, you have very different images. Still, this is a very beautiful
yes.
kind of thing.
Yes, definitely. Okay. So these are. They are not pines going to itself, but also to other languages, giving this some other aus. In this case, it's a Ruby program. It starts here. This outputs the source code of a Rust program. If we compile this in Rust, it returns a Scala and Scala program, and so on. They are sorted alphabetically, from what I can see. So 128 pieces, and if you gun to the circle for one for full round, then you are back at the program. And so it also contains an image of itself. And so given this, given all these properties, this is amazingly short. And this was really, really fun trying this out, to compile this by yourself. And so I tried this out here. There's a very good instruction manual here, what you can do with that. So download all these dependencies, install all these dependencies, and then let's start with Ruby, and then in Rust, and then Scala, and so on. Or alternatively, if you have all alternatively, you can just type make. Okay.
Okay, cool. Well, you had a few tricks up your sleeve before. I'd like to continue it. I also have a few tricks up my sleeve. We have a bit of experience in the development of games. We wrote one example together 1.5 years ago or so. I think it was about time, or even earlier, when there was this Twitter thread where someone asked what secret tricks there are in games. I really like to take a look behind the curtains, and this was really exciting for me. And well, from my favorite list, the first ones are a bit more obvious, like being in a fight, like here with Bioshock, with several opponents around you, and most of the times they don't attack at all from behind, or much more slowly, because it's not really nice, you can't really react to it. And another answer was like, if several opponents attack, then in our game there can be maximum of two, and the others, they're just on the side, and they scream to kind of hide that they don't want to run over the player. It reminds me of films like really choreographed fights, where you also see that there are not too many people running towards you, because it doesn't work. And what's quite similar is when you look at shooters, if you're getting shot at, which is not in your eyesight, then it very often happens that you're not hit at all, or only very slightly. It's kind of like the warning shot. Sometimes there's a visual of from where the shot is coming from. But so some people took it a bit farther, so that was exciting. And on the other hand, if you just fired your last bullet, this bullet likes to do more damage to kind of save you in a way. And it's similar with your last bottle of life. It most of the time has more points than all the others to practically guarantee your survival.
This is kind of thwarting you.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't improve the result, but I thought it was nice to try it. And we want the player to have the experience to have to survive just by an inch. And that was so good. And yeah, those are the little tricks. And here, talking about platform games, I think everyone has seen this. This is Coyote Time. They call what they call a user. If you jump from platform to platform, there is this moment where you actually stand still mid-air. You would fall, but you can still trigger the jump. It's kind of a bit of support to give the player a better feeling, because otherwise it would be much more frustrating than it is anyway. And the classics mostly go in that direction. Oops, sorry, wrong direction. And I think you might know this one also. It's your partner, kind of. It's a dog. Sometimes you have a horse. And there are probably a thousand of other variants. And you also see that with AI, you're accompanied by some character that's not the smartest. They get stuck somewhere or get lost, or you're just too fast because they run much slower. And the secret trick is to just set them to screen response, and then suddenly they appear behind someone again. So you cannot hide that that choreography was not that grand. So
it was awesome to see how fast they caught up.
Yeah, I think there were also some funny YouTube videos about games like Sherlock Holmes, where Watson always just out of nowhere reappears and it looks like teleporting. And yeah, it's a bit exaggerated and gets you really out of the mood. Yeah, you can overdo it, certainly. And then there are games like Resident Evil 4. Their difficulty is really adaptable, meaning if I play a level and I'm really struggling and I die and I start from a new chapter, suddenly I have less opponents spawning or weaker opponents who adapt to your skill. It's interesting. Resident Evil 4 shows that strongly. And also speedrunners like to use it. They like to die at a certain point to restart the level with less opponents and to get through faster. So it can be kind of tactics involved. And also similar could be Mario Kart, because the last player is likely to get the better items when they collect them. Yeah. So this screenshot is a bit smaller. I'm not sure if I took it from the right game. It's about Jedi Academy. A Twitter user wrote that you could make some combos. I mean, I'm not that interested in Star Wars. So you throw flashes and somebody has a sword and you have great combos there. They really look spectacular. But the problem was that the opponents have to stand close together or a bit lined up in order for the combo, for this flash to work. And this doesn't happen as often as the developers would like to. And so they sent the opponents somewhere where they arrange themselves into the fitting formation. or they just tumble around into the right formation. So it can really unfold, and yeah, it gives the player a feeling of power. And then we have Guitar Hero, which was also really nice. Not sure if it's true, but a developer wrote that after the game, there is always a ranking based on a 5-star system. But in truth, only the stars from 3 to 5 are rated, and nobody rates 1 or 2 stars, because that just gives a bad feeling. But at least, you know, you have been average. That's really cute. It reminds me like some surveys giving a scholar, people tend to not take the extremes because you don't want to offend anyone.
I know this from my mooch tracking, that I never go to cool down, because I always can imagine me in an even worse mood here. So
exactly. Yeah, you have to trick yourself. And yeah. What goes a bit into the combo direction is this example. There are many explosives throughout the levels, and the bullets are kind of steered in a way that they hit explosives, so it makes it more thrilling. And in the comments about those shooter games, you can see that those bullets are really steered to hit the opponents or exciting items to give a bit of a buffer. Yeah, so many things exploding here. And my last example is from Hellblade. Here is a spoiler. Just turn off the sound if you still want to play it. In Hellblade is like that, that the story starts with a kind of the past, like you see it here a little bit, the Black Death crawling up the arm. And the game tells you that every time you die, it gets worse, and it will grow until it fully consumes you. So your life is not infinite, but you don't know how many times you can actually die. And yeah, here's the spoiler. So the game just tries to trick you, so you actually don't die. And many people were actually mad when they found out. I thought it was grand, because it put so much pressure on me that I didn't finish the game. And yeah, it's something interesting psychologically, that just by the storytelling, the story of something bad happening, you can build up that much pressure. And it seems to be similar in games with a timer function that should make you pressure. You kind of have 5 minutes time, but in reality it's 8 minutes. So yeah, time runs a bit slower than they say. It's also a bit mean.
In Antichamber, there's some moment, I don't know whether you played this.
No, not yet.
It was some kind of puzzle game. So 1 hour counts down, and it was they tell you you only have this 1 hour to finish this game, and at some point the clock vanishes.
Oh, wow, that's cool. Yeah, super. Then I hand over to you.
Okay, so, now this is going to be about building botanics, a short segment where I just express my enthusiasm about something existing. I would like to have you guess what could this be about.
So about integrating plants in the architecture?
Yes, as a solar punk, this is nice. It's just as you say, you combine living plants and things that are made from other materials. This is a concept for a kind of pavilion where the different floors are carried or borne by this wood. I think the University of Stuttgart is where this started. People were researching about how this could be done, Here you have a metal rod held by a tree. So how can we link these two so that they are stable and that how can things still grow? Of course, this takes many years until it's quite fixed, but then it's quite a solid link, actually, and this direction, in this direction, there are various research projects. So how do you create a structure like this? You start by growing a tree, and then you have these plants. And you can then cut the roots, and the neighbors will actually supply them. And by delicate pruning and stuff, you can have it grow in this way. So you have this kind of pear that was grown in this way and that has quite nicely grown in time. And this is a student project at the Technical University of Munich, where they created a pavilion like this with a roof for this group of trees. And they built it when it was fairly new. This is how it looked. And here are the images of how they wanted it to develop in the next few years. And it's a very nice future vision to have more things like this. Plants can give you shelter from heat and from rain, and you have a nice roof that integrates, and you combine these two worlds, really. And this is something where I would again like to have you guess. What is this? What could this grow into? This is kind of linked, but it's a different direction.
I think I saw a
stool farm. Yes, exactly. This is a chair farm. So first you have the actual structure, and you let these grow into each other. And I think this is great. You can then kind of harvest the chair after 6 to 9 years. You can dry it and sand it down, and this is how it looks in the end. It's very chic, takes a lot of patience, of course.
The ultimate generative chair.
Yes, and the randomness of nature is being used here. Right.
Very cool. So everything's really good because we are matching each other. I have orbit over plants with me, and 2 years ago, I encountered cyanotype. This is many people made study, but I totally passed by me. In many chairs, this seems to be a child experiment, mostly in U.S. schools probably, but I never learned about this earlier. So I've brought a video. Let's try whether I can run this.
It sounds like color.
Yes, so the idea is I do some kind of photo print with light, with UV light. So so the nice thing here is that it's can easily done this all yourself, and it's non-toxic, and you don't need to need special developers and thousands of bath of liquids and all this chemistry and stuff. Mm-hmm. And very so this the center to be is the predecessor of us in the sense that you can create this this on your own, made from two chemicals. You just buy them, you have to mix them. And then you get some yellow greenish liquid. You just put it on there, and you should do this in a darkened room if possible, because it's this liquid is sensitive to UV. So if it's dried, you should keep it in a in some cardboard box, something like that. And if you have done this, then you can. So let's just go into the video. Which can think what you want to put here. So you take some photo, take it as a negative, and then get light on this. But you can also take plants, leaves, whatever you want. You just need some kind of nice negative. And so the best way to do this is to fixate in this with some sheet of glass. So this person here built their own special box for that. But in summer, you can easily do this just by going outside in the garden, because the sun is definitely strong enough to do this in summer. So if you do this in summer, it looks like that, still under some glass pane here. And so then you need to wait for some 5 to 10 minutes here. And so then you need to process it. If it darkens here, you can just take it with you. And the last step here is just simply wash it in water. And the UV sensitiveness, these particles get blue and stick to the paper, and the rest you just wash away from the paper. So that's a very simple process. So, and because if you didn't wash enough, you can just continue these steps, and you then just let it dry, and you have a great print from that. And it was fascinating how simple it is to do that. And okay, my slides. So again, for the chemicals. So these are the English terms, to chemicals, for example, in a pharmacy, drugstore, you just put them into the distilled water. It doesn't last very long, so you should use it directly when you mix it up. Also can play around with the exposure time, something like 20 minutes or 2 hours, something like that, depending on the amount of sun here. But we can see if you use this leaf like that, you can just exposure for some longer time, and you get lots and lots of details depending on the amount of UV radiation that goes through. Very nice. But you can also do this on cloth. So if you don't want to use a paper, for example, on cotton here, and it's usually done with plants, because that is very, very nice patterns, and it's not too difficult. But by now, it's also being used in modern arts. For example, here, very nice print from a negative from architectural photography, or here from mixed with other materials, kind of a silhouette print from the side. I like this a lot. And the link here in my thought. So this is how you created the actual blueprints back then. I didn't realize this before, that this is how blueprints are working. So you expose the some transparent paper, and what you keep is the blueprint of that.
Okay, funny. I've never actually questioned this kind of aesthetic of these sketches.
So if you want to try this out, so there are a couple of difficult recipes in the network, but they're also rather similar here on what else to put in. Well, it put gelatin in here, how to put it on paper to avoid this entering the paper way too deep, about different exposure times. It's just fun to experiment with that, and especially in summer, do these prints. Very fun activity. I can just recommend.
Yeah, well, the things you've shown, it's kind of a, I wonder if you could use a camera obscura and use that. It will take a long time, surely.
So I found one blog post where someone did this, and it did pretty well for one photo, but it's more tricky, because the exposure time is super, super long here. You can't really, so if you just put it into some direction, so you're not even putting this directly into the sun, so there's even a lot less light than with that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, just try out. So theoretically, it's possible, but you have to take care of the exposure time. But on a very bright sunny day, leaving it standing around for a day, maybe.
It's kind of charming that you can only photograph things this way that are outside, in an internal room. Work.
Yes. So it's you need a lot of UV light, but it's
not. Yeah, it's not, so yeah, it's not, that, not that nice sympathetic. Anymore. Okay, the slide design is a bit of blueprint as well.
I had this in episode 1 with the Voyager Golden Record, and so on one side is sounds, and on the other side the instructions on how to play the sound. And last year I found another thing that can do it in much more depth to communicate with aliens. And so imagine we ourselves are aliens on a different planet. We don't know anything about humans. We have developed electronics. We can spy into space with radio telescopes. And one day we receive a message, a binary coded message, which is quite long. 370,000 bits in total, and it ends like this. And now there's the question, what are we going to do with it? So we don't have any shared culture or anything with human beings or where this potentially comes from. How do we tackle this? What's your idea? How do we analyze it?
Wow, difficult. Well, it's kind of conspicuously sequential. I think this, if this would arrive in a very solid, steady rhythm, it might be artificial intelligence. My first thought would be, I'll mirror it back, send the same thing back, and see if it comes back yet again. The kind of question-answer thing.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, these sections are conspicuous.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really a pattern. It's there's a regularity in there. And I'd also say it's worth having a look at and getting the idea, like I did on this slide, that maybe the lines are not long enough. And if we choose a different length for the lines,
oh wow,
then you see a little bit more of structure, more diagonal line or something. But maybe we shorten it that all the ones are in one line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's still a bit irregular, but there are some structures in there. Mm-hmm. Diagonally arranged, but let's shorten it a bit more. And now we have reached a point where we can say, okay, we did something right.
Yeah, maybe we can, there's a kind of frame maybe that we can add, yeah?
Yeah, a frame of ones. To see it better, we can turn the ones into black pixels and the zeros to white ones.
Ah.
That's definitely an interesting structure in this message. And also the pages are in a square format now, and look like this. And the message contains quite a lot of these pages, and all the messages that we got in a completely alien language to us. We kind of don't know really what it is. We don't understand the language of the people who sent this, and we have to try to start from scratch and decode it. And this poses the question, how can a message be built in order to enable us to do so? So let's zoom into the first page and look at its structure. So on top, we can find those things in the corner, a sign in the middle here, and we can find this structure in every corner of every page. It could be a title or something, what it means. Well, we don't have context or anything in order to understand it. But after it, there comes a paragraph. It's made of different black squares, like here, for example. You have an idea what this paragraph could be about, like at the beginning of this message.
Well, I would imagine a table of contents, an index. And what I can't spontaneously fathom is, well, these little crosses. Ah, no, are they a binary counter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Somehow symbols.
Okay, yeah, we haven't seen them. Those are new to us. But at some point, our alien scientists had the idea that it could be numbers. So these black squares are binary. So maybe 4 0 bits and then a 1 bit and at another position. And they're divided by a sign like this symbol. It should kind of symbol equality. And after it, there's another symbol and then the numbers. So the people who sent this, these humans out there in the universe, maybe they chose the signs in a way that they themselves can recognize them. Maybe for them, it looks like a 0, 1, maybe a 2 with a bit of fantasy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's, yeah, 4, 5, turn around 6, 7, 8, 9. How does it continue?
Yeah, okay.
With 10 cards, we suddenly have 2 symbols, meaning the people who sent this, they took 10 as a basis. And explain it to us in a way that they are doing it like this. So an 11 is a 1 and a 1, and so on. And at the end of the page, we find this structure. We could do it like an encyclopedia to draw up what they mean.
Yes.
So.
7, 11, these are prime numbers.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the double check for us to make sure we have understood correctly, because it's our structure we developed independently from those humans or mathematics. Yeah, maybe it's the 30 first prime numbers, and then there's something more, 2 dots. So it could be. We don't really have an idea what it means. Maybe it could be a 1, but in the latter context, we will learn that it's kind of a potential, and it's the largest prime number that human beings had discovered at that time. And yeah, they kind of tell about their own technical progress they made. Yeah, that's how far they come. And this is how it works. This is our number system we established, and it goes on and on. It's about mathematical operations. There's a 1, another 1, and yeah, maybe a 2. And at this point, it could be a plus or a divider. So we establish a plus, a minus, or a multiplicator. So 4 divided by 3 is 1.3 periodically. And then kind of those steps for etc. We can calculate a little bit here. And on the next page, it's about geometry. We have the sign for P mentioned for the first time. So P is 3.1, blah, 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 and it goes on, and Yeah, there are a few more digits. And this was how far P had been defined at the point when the message was sent. And then double check with Pythagoras. This is about, do you know what this could mean? Those graphics with circles and small items. In the center, more items.
I have two hypotheses. Could be about the circumference, or it could be about the planets.
Yeah, this would also have been my first tip. Orbits of things. I think together with the numbers we find at the bottom, we as aliens could somehow find out that it's about physics. And this is a depiction of atoms and electrons circulating around those. They are of the same weight as the atoms. And from these you can divine certain units. And this is a depiction of a solar system. And I don't know, our sun has this kind of mass. And you see one planet is marked. It comes with a later message. There comes a symbol depicting a detail about this planet. Those are kind of the chemical basics we have worked on in the meantime. Mm-hmm. So our air consists of oxygen and nitrogen and CO2. And you can see mountains and what they are made of. And because we can't know what they're about, they painted a falling square there to depict gravity. And here we have some small shapes that run around there. And they might depict the human beings and how their cells are functioning and produce energy and how they reproduce. And the last page of the message is a very special one. We see this kind of flower in the middle. It was also introduced in earlier equations. It's about the unknown, about questions. This is the page where we as aliens are being asked many things, like what are your units, how much do you weigh? And this little domino stone depicts the universe and the characteristics of it. And yeah, this is an open question to us. And this message, she was sent to the universe by a big radio telescope. It was part of a movement called Active SETI Research for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And active means we don't just listen in, but we actively communicate into outer space and see if we can get an answer. I think this message is still traveling to the star where it was sent to. Maybe it arrives in 50 years or so. And it was hotly debated if it was a good idea.
If we wouldn't attract something evil, right?
So the question was, for example, whether the raised hand was considered an aggressive gesture by these aliens. And so it was a nice idea to read this message and try to understand. I'd make a little booklet out of that, a little gain of that, cutting this into different rows and columns and everything.
But of course, as soon as when we meet someone new, we might use this. Yeah. Just the thought to consider how do you compress a lot of knowledge into small space, and how do you work it out in a way that someone can understand that has no cultural overlap with you at all? very, very interesting.
So I can imagine that we as humans are very similar in culture. It might be that we just overlook a couple of things, which might be very difficult to understand by other people. Maybe aliens couldn't really imagine the idea of orthogonality, or really not understanding the space here, or in which direction to read all of that. But here, I think it's whether it doesn't really matter in which direction to decode, but yeah.
Really interesting. Cool. I don't really know how to link this to the next item. I like laser cutters. I enjoy them. And recently I learned a few nice processing technologies. What most of us maybe have seen already is already quite cool. So you can put things onto a laser cutter and have very fine strips. And you can, if you use wood, you can make wood very nicely bendable this way and build boxes out of it. Kind of bags. And this is quite well known, I think, using wood in this way and weakening it. But I have two other cool things. This is called Laser Origami. A research group at the, I forget where, and they do cool things. I think this is Perspex, and they can do various operations. Cut them like this, cut it like this, but you can also use the laser to take it out of focus and then heat parts of that Perspex, and that again gives you different weakness for that material. And you can then bend it and fold it, and therefore you can fold Perspex in the cutter. I think that is pretty cool. And this video includes some more examples and shows you the way the software is built. Maybe not that interesting anymore, but another nice video I brought, that's this one. So we've just seen bending. You can heat things by taking the laser out of focus. You kind of cut in the wrong way. But you can also do different things. Here, there are various layers of Perspex glass, and through the focus, you can decide which layer is melted into what other, and which one is cut, and that gives you very new options and things to construct. Let's jump into the video a bit. So we have a functioning scissors, a pair of scissors that was made in this way. Yeah, that's
it's done when it's leaves the laser cutter.
You have to kind of dissolve it, and then you have this pinball table, which is cut. Yeah. So this really, just by, this is an architectural model, but what I find interesting is that the layers can be melted into each other so that it actually holds together quite well. I don't know how stable it is exactly, because it's just the edges that are being melted together. But if you look at the pinball example, it does seem to be pretty stable. And sadly, my software doesn't make me unfocus the laser. So I haven't tried it myself, but I really enjoyed this, and it was quite unexpected to me, and a very good use of a laser cutter.
So it is probably very, very fast compared to 3D printing. Although, so they worked something like 4 hours at this bending example. So you probably need to be careful not to melt too fast.
I guess it will take a bit of time. So actually, the advantage here is, compared to 3D printing, the problem with the laser cutter normally is you cannot kind of have an overlapping part, because you can only cut things out of plates, but this kind of melting things together is interesting, because maybe that gets me back to kind of an overlap. You might fuse things together, and what is possible is a laser sintering printer, so where you print with powder, everything is in this kind of bed of powder, and you can... But these devices are really expensive, and these two lasers in the video are at a price level that is possible. You could buy this. And that is interesting, if this gets cheaper this way.
And as you said, nice unexpected application and a hack of these laser cutters. Okay, so next theme I brought to you, next topic is another riddle here, another puzzle, the Bongard problems, called after a Russian scientist of 1936, something like that, who thought a certain way of building a certain kind of puzzle looking like that. So you have two big pages, and both pages are showing some square-like picture, like figure. The trick is, so between the one page and the other page, one side and the other side, there is a clear difference. So here, for example, you could say everything on the left side is larger than a certain thing, and everything on the right-hand side is smaller than this reference here. So that's one example here. So here's a different one. If you want, can think what this is about. This might be about.
So on both sides, the forms are filled and not filled with color. We have round shapes and square shapes. And on both sides, we have a smaller shape.
But that's all things. That's probably not what this is not about.
And on the right, we have convex shapes. Or concave, sorry. I always confuse those two. Well, one bent to the inside and the other one the other way.
And that's it. Sometimes there's more than one correct solution, but I would say this is what this is about. It's pretty clear that these are bent to the inside. And so if you take some rubber tape and put it around, then here it covers everything on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, it doesn't touch everything. And this is what the whole thing is about. And here are two collections of those problems. And I think this one was very interesting. So we can just... So let's just try to solve a few of them together. Let's... Something from the first part, which hopefully are not too difficult. So let's see what we can get there. So, so triangles, squares, circles, some filled, some not.
I just wanted to say that on one side they separate the black from the white ones, but yeah, no.
So what I noticed that on the left hand there are lots of black ones, at least three or something like that, but here's another one with two.
Okay, and there are another two on the other side.
And exactly, so there are lots of criteria that you can try.
There is a triangle standing on its head, so only on the right side.
You're right. That's suspicious. But others here don't have this.
True, like every section has to have everything. Okay. Well, okay, that doesn't make sense. That's difficult.
I don't know whether here in this talk we should find some solution in this time.
Whatever is on our cheat sheet.
So there's some directory of solutions. So there's solutions. More solid black figures on one side, more outline figures on the other side.
All right. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, right. Here, they're in the majority here. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now, this is very interesting pastime to puzzle and to have fun because there are so many things this can be about. And I don't know. Let's jump into something later, which are probably a lot advanced. Ah, okay. So three-dimensional bodies. So here it's obvious. That's always
always two of the same. So the left is more of the same, whatever it is.
Yeah. On the right-hand side, different categories, and left is the same. I would say this as well. And I saw there are 300, something like 300 there. On the other collection, there are more than 1,000. So that's a collaborative project that collects them. And so it's classified by the curtain there. And there's a certain kind of these problems, which are the meta-bounded problems, which so they differentiate other how the kind of solutions are constructed. So if you want, you can try to give it a thought what this is about, how the solutions, what's the difference between the solutions on the one side and to the difference of the solutions on the other side. But I would say that's I hand over to you.
Okay. But yeah, those quizzes always are really much fun. Let's go to the last section. I called it tech and crafting. So it's a collection of interesting stuff. Things that have to do with technology, electronics, and classic handiwork techniques. Crafting techniques. What I really liked is a project, you pronounce it Chise, I hope, and there was a pattern produced by knitting, and in that there is this leading thread, and it created a stretch board. So you can directly connect to those knitted points and put LEDs on it. And yeah, I really liked it because I'm also someone who never has enough of these boards. And I thought that was super flexible. And this is actually a research project from a design university, which I found really cool. It's about during the process of weaving to produce a smart fabric, so as well as sensors as actual tokens, so you can feel it and also trigger it. And what I really liked is that you start by weaving it and don't alter the fabric only in the aftermath. My favorite example is the next one. So you insert a leading thread or kind of a wire that shrinks because of heat or can also enlarge. And yeah, can attach electricity or not. These projects are about to have the fabric interact with the skin and the body. So you see that it's directly attached to the skin. There are a few examples, and they're going the whole way, you know. As I said, they start the process with the weaving in the weaving stool, really get it started from scratch, which is really rare with smart fabrics, because usually it's just applied to the fabric. Or maybe I'm just into weaving, who knows?
Ein letztes Projekt habe ich noch einfach von Louise Ehrenberg, die habe ich im Laufe des Jahres mal kennengelernt.
And I learned about this last project from someone who thought about how you can use textile as a marker. So if you think about kilting or just generally textile patterns, you wonder which patterns are useful also by hand embroidery. So this was a fantastic talk, very interesting to watch. I have a second video with an embroidered marker to project something onto. I really like this. So they said, this integrates with the idea of mending if you want to fix some hole or something. So the patterns that come about as you patch up a piece of cloth. And these are interesting, nice combinations. How do you say it? This kind of injury of the textile is turned into something interesting, and you can make some VR thing out of it.
So I think that the patterns suitable for this are have a certain aesthetic, I think. So having lots of contrast, things like that.
Yes, they have a lot of contrast, and they're not very repetitive. So uniqueness and contrast are a good thing here.
And rotatability.
Yeah. So this way, a whole unique aesthetic is created. Yeah. And that gets us to the end of this year's run through. I hope you had fun. Inri and I do many projects that are about art, creativity, and tech. And if you've enjoyed this, I would be happy if you could join us at Patreon, because we are all both freelancers and do these kinds of projects, so we are happy for your support. You will surely find the slides linked somewhere, and if you've just watched this in the live stream, we are probably in some big blue button room where you can find us and talk with us a little and ask questions. Let's meet and chat. And otherwise, we'll wish you a nice winter time, and we're looking forward to the next Chaos event in real life.
See you all.
Bye bye. Thank you to Lindri and Liebtrack for these very interesting insights that you've given to us. I hope all people in the audience are just as curious as I am now to look at more things that these two have done. So earlier episodes of Operation